perhaps Einstein envisioned years earlier when he dallied with the cosmological constant and would propel a spectacular spatial stretching. That alone was exciting. But Guth realized there was an indispensable bonus. The same reasoning that explains why a uniform field has negative pressure applies as well to a cosmological constant. If the bottle contains empty space, endowed with a cosmological constant, then when you slowly remove the cork, the extra space you make available within the bottle contributes extra energy. The only source for this extra energy is your muscles, which therefore must have strained against an inward, negative pressure supplied by the cosmological constant. And as with a uniform field, a cosmological constant's uniform negative pressure also yields repulsive gravity. But the vital point here is not the similarities per se, but the manner in which a cosmological constant and a uniform field differ. A cosmological constant is just that, a constant, a fixed number inserted on the third line of general relativity's tax form that would generate the same repulsive gravity today as it would have billions of years ago. By contrast, the value of a field can change and generally will. When you turn on your microwave oven, you change the electromagnetic field filling its interior. When the technician flips the switch on an MRI machine, he or she changes the electromagnetic field threading the cavity. Guth realized that an inflaton field filling space could behave similarly, turning on for a burst and then turning off, which would allow repulsive gravity to operate during only a brief window of time. That's essential. Observations establish that if the blistering growth of space happened at all, it must have happened billions of years ago and then sharply dropped off to the statelier pace expansion evidenced by detailed astronomical measurements. So, an all-important feature of the inflationary proposal is that the era of powerful repulsive gravity be transient. The mechanism for turning on and then shutting off the inflationary burst relies on physics that Guth initially developed, but that Linde and Albrecht and Steinhardt refined substantially. To get a feel for their proposal, think of a ball. Better still, think of a nearly round Eric Cartman perched precariously on one of South Park's snow-covered mountains. A physicist would say that because of his position, Cartman embodies energy. More precisely, he embodies potential energy, meaning that he has pent-up energy that's ready to be tapped, most easily by his tumbling downward, which would transform the potential energy into the energy of motion, kinetic energy. Experience attests, and the laws of physics make precise, that this is typical. A system harboring potential energy will exploit any opportunity to release that energy. In short, things fall. The energy carried by a field's non-zero value is also potential energy. It, too, can be tapped, resulting in an incisive analogy with Cartman. Just as the increase in Cartman's potential energy as he climbs a mountain is determined by the shape of the slope. In flatter regions, his potential energy varies minimally as he walks because he gets hardly any higher, while in steeper regions, his potential energy rises sharply. The potential energy of a field is described by an analogous shape called its potential energy curve. Such a curve determines how a field's potential energy varies with its value. Following inflation's pioneers, let's then imagine that in the earliest moments of the cosmos, space is uniformly filled with an inflaton field whose value places it high up on its potential energy curve. Imagine, further, these physicists urge us, that the potential energy curve flattens out into a gentle plateau, allowing the inflaton to linger near the top. Under these hypothesized conditions, what will happen? Two things, both critical. While the inflaton is on the plateau, it fills space with a large potential energy and negative pressure, driving a burst of inflationary expansion. But just as Cartman releases his potential energy by rolling down the slope, so the inflaton releases its potential energy by its value throughout space, rolling to lower numbers. And as its value decreases, the energy and negative pressure it harbors dissipate, bringing an end to the period of blistering expansion. Just as important, the energy released by the inflaton field isn't lost. Instead, like a cooling vat of steam condensing into water droplets, the inflaton's energy condenses into a uniform bath of particles that fill space. This two-step process, brief but rapid expansion, followed by energy conversion to particles, results in a huge, uniform spatial expanse that's filled with the raw material of familiar structures like stars and galaxies. Precise details depend on factors that neither theory nor observation has as yet determined. The initial value of the inflaton field, the exact shape of the potential energy slope, and so on. But in typical versions, the mathematical calculations show that the inflaton's energy would roll down the slope in a tiny fraction of a second, on the order of 10 to the minus 35 seconds. And yet, during that brief span, space would expand by a colossal factor, perhaps 10 to the 30, if not more. These numbers are so extreme that they defy analogy. They imply that a region of space the size of a pea would be stretched larger than the observable universe in a time interval so short that the blink of an eye would overestimate it by a factor larger than a million, billion, billion, billion. However difficult it is to envision such a scale, what's essential is that the region of space that spawned the observable universe was so small that it would easily have come to a uniform temperature before it was stretched into our grand cosmic expanse by the rapid burst. The inflationary expansion and billions of years of subsequent cosmological evolution resulted in this temperature cooling substantially, but the uniformity set in place early on dictates a uniform result today. This resolves the mystery of how the universe's uniform conditions came to be. In inflation, a uniform temperature across space is inevitable. Eternal inflation. During the nearly three decades since its discovery, inflation has become a fixture of cosmological investigation. But to have an accurate picture of the research panorama, you should be aware that inflation is a cosmological framework, but it is not a specific theory. Researchers have shown that there are many ways to skin an inflationary cat, differing in details such as the number of inflaton fields supplying the negative pressure, the particular potential energy curves to which each field is subject, and so on. Fortunately, the sundry realizations of inflation have some implications in common, so we can draw conclusions even in the absence of a definitive version. Among these, one first fully realized by Alexander Vilenkin of Tufts University and developed further by others, including most notably Linde, is of great importance. In fact, it's the very reason I've spent the first half of this chapter explaining the inflationary framework. In many versions of the inflationary theory, the burst of spatial expansion is not a one-time event. Instead, the process by which our region of the universe formed, rapid stretching of space followed by a transition to more ordinary, slower expansion, together with the production of particles, this may happen over and over again at various far-flung locations throughout the cosmos. From a bird's-eye view, the cosmos would appear riddled with innumerable, widely separated regions, each being the aftermath of a portion of space transitioning out of the inflationary burst. Our realm, what we have always thought of as the universe, would then be but one of these numerous regions floating within a vastly larger spatial expanse. If intelligent life exists in the other regions, those beings would just as surely have thought their universe to be the universe too. And so inflationary cosmology steers us headlong into our second variation on the theme of parallel universes. To grasp how this inflationary multiverse comes about, we need to engage two complications that my Cartman analogy glossed over. First, the image of Cartman perched high on a mountaintop offered an analogy to an inflaton field harboring significant potential energy and negative pressure, poised to roll to lower values. But whereas Cartman is perched on a single mountaintop, the inflaton field has a value at each point in space. The theory posits that the inflaton field starts off with the same value at each location within an initial region. And so we'd achieve a more faithful rendering of the science if we imagine something a little odd. Numerous Cartman clones perched on numerous closely packed identical mountaintops throughout a spatial expanse. Second, we've barely touched on the quantum aspect of quantum field theory. The inflaton field, like everything else in our quantum universe, is subject to quantum uncertainty. This means that its value will undergo random quantum jitters, momentarily rising a little here and dropping a little there. In everyday situations, quantum jitters are too small to notice, but calculations show that the larger the energy an inflaton has, the greater the fluctuations it will experience from quantum uncertainty. And since the inflaton's energy content during the inflationary burst was extremely high, the jitters in the early universe were big and dominant. We should thus not only picture a platoon of Cartmans perched high on identical mountaintops, we should also imagine that they are all subject to a random series of tremors, strong here, weak there, very strong way over there. With this setup, we can now determine what will happen. Different Cartman clones will stay perched on their mountaintops for different durations. In some locations, a strong tremor knocks most Cartmans down their slopes. In other locations, a mild tremor coaxes only a few to tumble down. In others still, some Cartmans may have started to roll down until a strong tremor knocked them back up. After a while, the terrain will be divided into a random assortment of domains, much as the United States is divided into states, in some of which no Cartmans are left on mountaintops, while in others, many Cartmans remain securely perched. The random nature of quantum jitters yields a similar conclusion for the inflaton field. The field begins high up on its potential energy slope at every point in a region of space. The quantum jitters then act like tremors. Because of this, the expanse of space rapidly divides into domains. In some, quantum jitters cause the field to topple down the slope, while in others, it remains high. So far, so good. But now, stay with me closely. Here's where cosmology and Cartmans differ. A field that's perched high up on its energy curve affects its environment far more significantly than a similarly perched Cartman does. From our familiar refrain, a field's uniform energy and negative pressure generate repulsive gravity, we recognize that the region the field permeates expands at a fantastic rate. This means that the inflaton field's evolution across space is driven by two opposing processes. Quantum jitters, by tending to knock the field off its perch, decrease the amount of space effused with high field energy. Inflationary expansion, by rapidly enlarging those domains in which the field remains perched, increases the volume of space effused with high field energy. Which process wins? In the vast majority of proposed versions of inflationary cosmology, the increase occurs at least as quickly as the decrease. The reason is that an inflaton field that can be knocked off its perch too quickly typically generates too little inflationary expansion to solve the horizon problem. In cosmologically successful versions of inflation, the increase thus wins over the decrease, ensuring that the total volume of space in which the field's energy is high increases over time. Recognizing that such field configurations yield yet further inflationary expansion, we see that once inflation begins, it never ends. It's like the spread of a viral pandemic. To eradicate the threat, you need to wipe out the virus faster than it can reproduce. The inflationary virus reproduces. A high field value generates rapid spatial expansion and thus infuses a yet larger domain with that same high field value. And it does so faster than the competing process eliminates it. The inflationary virus effectively resists eradication. Swiss cheese and the cosmos. Collectively, these insights show that inflationary cosmology leads to a vastly new picture of reality's expanse, one that can be grasped most easily with a simple visual aid. Think of the universe as a gigantic block of Swiss cheese, with the cheesy parts being regions where the inflaton field's value is high, and the holes being regions where it's low. That is, the holes are regions like ours that have transitioned out of the superfast expansion and in the process converted the inflaton field's energy into a bath of particles which over time may coalesce into galaxies, stars, and planets. In this language, what we found is that the cosmic cheese acquires more and more holes because quantum processes knock the inflaton's value downward at a random assortment of locations. At the same time, the cheesy parts stretch ever larger because they're subject to inflationary expansion driven by the high inflaton field value they harbor. Taken together, the two processes yield an ever-expanding block of cosmic cheese riddled with an ever-growing number of holes. In the more standard language of cosmology, each hole is called a bubble universe. Each is an opening tucked within the super-fast stretching cosmic expanse. Don't let the descriptive but diminutive sounding bubble universe fool you. Our universe is gigantic. That it may be a single region embedded within an even larger cosmic structure, a single bubble in an enormous block of cosmic cheese, speaks to the fantastic expanse in the inflationary paradigm of the cosmos as a whole. And this goes for the other bubbles too. Each would be as much a universe, a real, gigantic, dynamic expanse, as ours. There are versions of the inflationary theory in which inflation is not eternal. By fiddling with details such as the number of inflaton fields and their potential energy curves, clever theorists can arrange things so that the inflaton would, in due course, be knocked off its perch everywhere. But these proposals are the exception rather than the rule. Garden variety inflationary models yield a gargantuan number of bubble universes carved into an eternally expanding spatial expanse. And so, if the inflationary theory is on the mark, and if, as many theoretical investigations conclude, its physically relevant realization is eternal, the existence of an inflationary multiverse would be an inevitable consequence. Changing perspectives. Back in the 1980s, when Vilenkin realized the eternal nature of inflationary expansion and the parallel universes to which it would give rise, he excitedly visited Alan Guth at MIT to tell him about it. Midway through the explanation, Guth's head drooped forward. He'd fallen asleep. This was not necessarily a bad sign. Guth is famous for nodding off during physics seminars. He's caught a few winks during talks I've given. Then opening his eyes midway through to ask the most insightful of questions. But the broader physics community was no more enthusiastic than Guth was, so Vilenkin shelved the idea and moved on to other projects. Sentiment today is very different. When Vilenkin was first thinking about the inflationary multiverse, the evidence in direct support of the inflationary theory itself was thin. So, to the few who paid any attention at all, ideas about inflationary expansion yielding a vast collection of parallel universes seemed like speculation piled upon speculation. But in the years since, the observational case for inflation has grown much stronger, once again, thanks largely to precise measurements of the microwave background radiation. Even though the observed uniformity of the microwave background radiation was one of the prime motivations for developing the inflationary theory, early proponents realized that rapid spatial expansion would not render the radiation perfectly uniform. Instead, they argued that quantum mechanical jitters, stretched large by the inflationary expansion, would overlay the uniformity with minuscule temperature variations, like tiny ripples on the surface of an otherwise smooth pond. This has proved to be a spectacular and enormously influential insight. Here's how it goes. Quantum uncertainty would have caused the value of the inflaton field to jitter. Indeed, if the inflationary theory is correct, the burst of inflationary expansion stopped here because a large and lucky quantum fluctuation, nearly 14 billion years ago, knocked the inflaton off its perch in our vicinity. Yet there's more to the story. As the inflaton's value rolled down its slope, headlong toward the point of bringing inflation in our bubble universe to a close, its value would still have been subject to quantum jitters. The jitters, in turn, would have made the inflaton's value a little higher here and a little lower there, like the wavy surface of an unfurled sheet as it descends to your mattress. This would have produced slight variations in the energy the inflaton harbored across space. Normally, such quantum variations are so tiny and happen over such minuscule scales that they are irrelevant over cosmological distances. But inflationary expansion is anything but normal. The expansion of space is so rapid, even during the transition out of the inflationary phase, that the microscopic would have been stretched to the macroscopic. And much as a tiny message scribbled on a deflated balloon becomes easier to read when air stretches the balloon surface, so the influence of quantum jitters becomes visible when inflationary expansion stretches the cosmic fabric. More particularly, minute energy differences caused by quantum jitters are stretched into temperature variations that become imprinted in the cosmic microwave background radiation. Calculations show that the temperature differences wouldn't exactly be huge, but could be as large as a thousandth of a degree. If the temperature is 2.725 Kelvin in one region, the stretched-out quantum jitters would result in its being a touch colder, say 2.7245 Kelvin, or a touch hotter, 2.7255 Kelvin, at nearby regions. Painstakingly precise astronomical observations have sought these temperature variations, and they've found them. Just as the theory predicted, they measure about a thousandth of a degree. More impressive still, the tiny temperature differences fit a pattern on the sky that is explained spot on by the theoretical calculations. A comparison of theoretical predictions of how the temperature should vary as a function of the distance between the two regions yields stunning agreement with the actual measurements. The 2006 Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded to George Smoot and John Mather, who led more than 1,000 researchers on the Cosmic Background Explorer team in the early 1990s to the first detection of these temperature differences. During the past decade, every new and more accurate measurement has resulted in yet more precise verification of the predicted temperature variations. These works have capped a thrilling story of discovery that began with the insights of Einstein, Friedmann, and Lemaître, was pushed sharply forward by the calculations of Gamow, Alpher, and Hermann, was reinvigorated by the ideas of Dickey and Peebles, was shown relevant by the observations of Penzias and Wilson, and has now culminated in the handiwork of armies of astronomers, physicists, and engineers whose combined efforts have measured a fantastically minute cosmic signature that was set in place billions of years ago. On a more qualitative level, we should all be thankful for the temperature variations in the microwave background radiation. At the close of inflation in our bubble universe, regions with slightly more energy, equivalently via E equals MC squared, regions with slightly more mass, exerted a slightly stronger gravitational pull, attracting more particles from their surroundings and thus growing larger. The larger aggregate, in turn, exerted an even stronger gravitational pull, thus attracting yet more matter and growing larger still. In time, the snowball effect resulted in the formation of clumps of matter and energy that over billions of years evolved into galaxies and the stars within them. In this way, inflationary theory establishes a remarkable link between the largest and the smallest structures in the cosmos. The very existence of galaxies, stars, planets, and life itself derives from microscopic quantum uncertainty amplified by inflationary expansion. Inflation's theoretical underpinnings may be rather tentative. The inflaton, after all, is a hypothetical field whose existence has yet to be demonstrated. Its potential energy curve is posited by researchers, not revealed by observation. The inflaton must somehow start at the top of its energy curve across a region of space, and so on. Despite all that, and even if some of the details of the theory are not quite right, the agreement between theory and observation has convinced many that the inflationary scheme taps into a deep truth about cosmic evolution. And since a great many versions of inflation are eternal, yielding an ever-growing number of bubble universes, theory and observation combine to make an indirect yet compelling case for this second version of parallel worlds. Experiencing the inflationary multiverse. In a quilted multiverse, there's no sharp divide between one parallel universe and another. All are part of a single spatial expanse whose overall qualitative features are similar from region to region. The surprise lies in the details. Most of us wouldn't expect worlds to repeat. Most of us wouldn't expect, every so often, to encounter versions of ourselves, our friends, our families. But if we could journey sufficiently far, that's what we would find. In an inflationary multiverse, the member universes are sharply divided. Each is a hole in the cosmic cheese, separated from the others by domains in which the inflaton's value remains high. Since such intervening regions are still undergoing inflationary expansion, the bubble universes are rapidly driven apart, with the speed of recession proportional to the amount of swelling space between them. The farther apart they are, the greater the expansion speed. The ultimate result is that distant bubbles move apart faster than the speed of light. Even with unlimited longevity and technology, there's no way to cross such a divide. There's no way to even send a signal. All the same, we can still imagine a voyage to one or more of the other bubble universes. On such a journey, what would you find? Well, because each bubble universe results from the same process, the inflaton is knocked from its perch, yielding a region that drops out of the inflationary expansion, they are all governed by the same physical theory, and so are all subject to the same set of physical laws. But much as the behavior of identical twins can differ profoundly as a result of environmental differences, identical laws can manifest themselves in profoundly different ways in different environments. Imagine, for example, that one of the other bubble universes looks much like ours, dotted by galaxies containing stars and planets, but with one essential difference. Permeating the universe is a magnetic field thousands of times stronger than that created in our most advanced MRI machines, and one that can't be switched off by a technician. Such a powerful field would affect the way a great many things behave. Not only would objects containing iron have a nasty habit of flying off in the direction of the field, but even basic properties of particles, atoms, and molecules would shift. A sufficiently strong magnetic field would so disrupt cellular function that life as we know it couldn't take hold. Yet, just as the physical laws operating inside an MRI are the very same laws that operate outside, so the fundamental physical laws operating in this magnetic universe would be the same as ours. The discrepancies in experimental results and observational features would be due solely to an aspect of the environment, the strong magnetic field. Talented scientists in the magnetic universe would, in time, tease out this environmental factor and home in on the same mathematical laws we've discovered. Over the past 40 years, researchers have built a case for a similar scenario right here in our own universe. The most lauded theory of fundamental physics, the standard model of particle physics, posits that we are immersed in an exotic mist called the Higgs field, named after the English physicist Peter Higgs, who with important contributions from Robert Brout, François Englert, Gerald Guralnick, Carl Hagen, and Tom Kibble, pioneered this idea in the 1960s. Both Higgs fields and magnetic fields are invisible and hence can fill space without directly revealing their presence. However, according to modern particle theory, a Higgs field camouflages itself far more fully. As particles move through a uniform space-filling Higgs field, they don't speed up, they don't slow down, they are not coaxed to follow particular trajectories as some would in the presence of a strong magnetic field. Instead, the theory claims their influence in ways more subtle and more profound. As fundamental particles burrow through a Higgs field, they acquire and maintain the mass that experiments have revealed them to possess. According to this idea, when you push against an electron or a quark in an effort to change its speed, the resistance you feel comes from the particles rubbing against the molasses-like Higgs field. It's this resistance that we call the particle's mass. Were you to remove the Higgs field from some region, particles passing through would suddenly become massless. Were you to double the value of the Higgs field in another region, particles passing through would suddenly have twice their usual mass. Such human-induced changes are hypothetical. because the energy required to substantially modify a Higgs field's value in even a small region of space is enormously beyond what we can muster. The changes are also hypothetical because the existence of the Higgs field is still up in the air. Theorists eagerly anticipate highly energetic collisions between protons at the Large Hadron Collider, chipping off small chunks of the Higgs field, Higgs particles, that may be detected in the coming years. But in many versions of inflationary cosmology, a Higgs field would naturally have different values in different bubble universes. A Higgs field, much like an inflaton field, has a curve that records the amount of energy it contains for various values it can assume. An essential difference from the inflaton field's energy curve, though, is that the Higgs typically settles not at the value zero, but rather rolls to one of potentially numerous troughs in its potential energy curve. Picture, then, an early stage in each of two bubble universes, ours and another. In both, the hot, tempestuous frenzy causes the value of the Higgs field to undulate wildly. As each universe expands and cools, the Higgs field calms, and its value rolls toward one of these troughs. In our universe, the Higgs field's value settles down in, say, one particular trough, giving rise to the particle properties familiar from experimental observation. But in the other universe, the Higgs motion may result in its value settling down in a different trough. If it did, that universe would have properties substantially different from ours. Although the underlying laws in both universes would be the same, the masses and various other properties of particles would not. Even a modest difference in particle properties would have weighty consequences. If the electron mass in another bubble universe were a few times larger than it is here, electrons and protons would tend to merge, forming neutrons, and thus preventing the widespread production of hydrogen. The fundamental forces, the electromagnetic force, the nuclear forces, and we believe gravity, are also communicated by particles. Change the particle properties, and you drastically change the properties of the forces. The heavier a particle, for example, the more sluggish its motion, and so the shorter the distance over which the corresponding force is transmitted. Formation and stability of atoms in our bubble universe rely on the properties of the electromagnetic and nuclear forces. If you substantially modify those forces, atoms will fall apart or, more likely, not coalesce in the first place. An appreciable change to the properties of particles would thus disrupt the very processes that give our universe its familiar features. The discussion so far has focused only on the simplest case, in which there is a single species of Higgs field. But theoretical physicists have explored more complicated scenarios involving multiple Higgs fields. We will shortly see that such possibilities naturally emerge from string theory, which translate into an even richer set of distinct bubble universes. The potential energy curve for the assortment of Higgs fields offers various troughs into which the Higgs field values in one or another bubble universe could settle into. Permeated by such unfamiliar values of various Higgs fields, these universes would differ from ours considerably. This would make a journey through the inflationary multiverse a perilous undertaking. Many of the other universes would not be places you'd want high in your itinerary, because the conditions would be incompatible with the biological processes essential to survival, giving new meaning to the saying that there's no place like home. In the inflationary multiverse, our universe could well be an island oasis in a gigantic, but largely inhospitable, cosmic archipelago. Universes in a nutshell. Because of their fundamental differences, the quilted and inflationary multiverses might appear unrelated. The quilted variety emerges if the extent of space is infinite. The inflationary variety emerges from eternal inflationary expansion. Yet, there is a deep and wonderfully satisfying connection between them, one that brings the discussion in the previous two chapters full circle. The parallel universes arising from inflation generate their quilted cousins. The process has to do with time. Of the many strange things Einstein's work revealed, the fluidity of time is the hardest to grasp, whereas everyday experience convinces us that there is an objective concept of time's passage. Relativity shows this to be an artifact of life at slow speeds and weak gravity. move near light speed, or immerse yourself in a powerful gravitational field, and the familiar universal conception of time will evaporate. If you're rushing past me, things I insist happened at the same moment will appear to you to have occurred at different moments. If you're hanging out near the edge of a black hole, an hour's passage on your watch will be monumentally longer on mine. This isn't evidence of a magician's trickery or a hypnotist's deception. The passage of time depends on the particulars, trajectory followed, and gravity experienced of the measurer. When applied to the entire universe, or to our bubble in an inflationary setting, this immediately raises a question. How does such malleable, custom-made time comport with the notion of an absolute cosmological time? We freely speak of the age of our universe, but given that galaxies are moving rapidly relative to one another, at speeds dictated by their various separations, doesn't the relativity of time's passage create a nightmarish accounting problem for any would-be cosmic timekeeper? More pointedly, when we speak of our universe being 14 billion years old, are we using a particular clock to measure that duration? We are. And a careful consideration of such cosmic time reveals a direct link between parallel universes of the inflationary and quilted varieties. Every method we use to measure time's passage involves an examination of change that occurs to some particular physical system. Using a common wall clock, we examine the change in position of its hands. Using the sun, we examine the change in its position in the sky. Using carbon-14, we examine the percentage of an original sample that's undergone radioactive decay to nitrogen. Historical precedent and general convenience have led us to use the rotation and revolution of the Earth as physical reference, giving rise to our standard notions of day and year. But when we're thinking on cosmic scales, there's another, more useful method for keeping time. We've seen that inflationary expansion yields vast regions whose properties on average are homogeneous. Measure the temperature, pressure, and average density of matter in two large but separate regions within a bubble universe, and the results will agree. The results can change over time, but the large-scale uniformity ensures that, on average, the change here is the same as the change there. As an important case in point, the mass density in our bubble universe has steadily decreased over our multi-billion-year history, thanks to the relentless expansion of space. But because the change has occurred uniformly, our bubble's large-scale homogeneity has not been disrupted. This proves important because just as the steadily decreasing amount of carbon-14 in organic matter provides a means of measuring time's passage on Earth, so the steadily decreasing mass density provides a means of measuring time's passage across space. And because the changes happened uniformly, mass density as a marker of time's passage provides our bubble universe with a global standard. If everyone diligently calibrates their watches to the average mass density and recalibrates after trips to black holes or periods of travel near light speed, the synchronicity of our timepieces across our bubble universe will be maintained. When we speak of the age of the universe, the age of our bubble, that is, it is on such cosmically calibrated watches that we imagine time's passage being measured. It is only with respect to them that cosmic time is a sensible concept. In the earliest era of our bubble universe, the same reasoning would have applied with one change of detail. Ordinary matter had yet to form, so we can't speak of the average mass density in space. Instead, the inflaton field carried our universe's storehouse of energy, energy that would shortly be converted into familiar particles. So we need to envision setting our clocks by the density of the inflaton field's energy. Now, the inflaton's energy is determined by its value, as summarized by its energy curve. To determine what time it is at a given location in our bubble, we therefore need to determine the value of the inflaton at that location. Then, just as two trees are the same age if they have the same number of tree rings, and just as two samples of glacial sediment are the same age if they have the same percentage of radioactive carbon. Two locations in space are passing through the same moment in time when they have the same value of the inflaton field. That's how we set and synchronize clocks in our bubble universe. The reason I brought all this up is that when applied to the cosmic Swiss cheese of the inflationary multiverse, these observations yield a strikingly counterintuitive implication. Much as Hamlet famously declares, "I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space," each of the bubble universes appears to have finite spatial extent when examined from the outside, but infinite spatial extent when examined from the inside. And that's a marvelous realization. Infinite spatial extent is just what we need for quilted parallel universes, so we can meld the quilted multiverse into the inflationary story. The extreme disparity between the outsiders' and insiders' perspectives arises because they have vastly different conceptions of time. Although the point is far from obvious, we'll now see that what appears as endless time to an outsider appears as endless space at each moment of time to an insider. Space in a bubble universe. To grasp how this comes about, imagine that Trixie, floating within a rapidly expanding inflaton-filled region of space, is observing the formation of a nearby bubble universe. Focusing her inflaton meter on the growing bubble, she is able to directly track the changing inflaton field value it contains. Although the region, the hole in the cosmic cheese, is three-dimensional, it's simpler to examine the field along a one-dimensional cross-section across its diameter, and as Trixie does so, she records the data in a chart. Each row of the chart displays the inflaton's value across the bubble at successive moments in time from her perspective. The data are thus a collection of numbers that fill out a grid, and let me describe what the numbers look like. Imagine that the inflaton's value outside of the bubble is, say, 100, and that as the bubble grows, there's an ever larger region in which the inflaton's value has dropped to lower values. The first line of Trixie's chart thus has a string of hundreds, the value of the inflaton to the left of the bubble's location, followed by the value 90 at the location where the tiny bubble is just starting to form, followed by another string of hundreds, the value of the inflaton to the right of the bubble's location. In the second line of her chart, the bubble has grown, so the two strings of hundreds, again denoting the inflaton values to the left and right of the bubble, now flank the numbers 90, 80, and 90. The third line of Trixie's chart follows suit. Two strings of hundreds flanking the numbers 90, 80, 70, 80, 90, as does the fourth. Two strings of hundreds now flanking 90, 80, 70, 60, 70, 80, 90, and so the pattern continues up the chart. Now imagine that Norton is also examining this very same bubble universe, but from the inside. He's hard at work making detailed astronomical observations with his own inflaton meter. Norton, unlike Trixie, adheres to a notion of time that's calibrated by the value of the inflaton. This is key to the conclusion we're chasing, so I need you to buy into it fully. Imagine, if you will, that everyone in the bubble universe wears a watch that measures and displays the inflaton's value. When Norton throws a dinner party, he instructs the guests to show up at his house when the inflaton's value is 60. Since everyone's watch is calibrated to the same uniform standard, the inflaton field's value, the party goes off without a hitch. Everyone shows up at the same moment because everyone is attuned to the same concept of synchronicity. With this understanding, it's a simple matter for Norton to work out the size of the bubble universe at any given moment of his time. In fact, it's child's play. All Norton has to do is paint by numbers. By connecting all points that have the same numerical value for the inflaton field, Norton can delineate all locations within the bubble at a single moment of time, his time, insider's time. If you're able to picture Norton's drawing, you'll understand the essential conclusion. Take, for example, the curve passing through points in space with inflaton field value 90. Every row in Trixie's chart has two such locations, and row by row, those two points get ever farther apart. This reflects the fact that as the bubble's diameter expands, its endpoints, where the inflaton field's value has dropped just a bit below that of the surrounding environment, separate ever further. Norton's curve passing through all locations with inflaton value 90 thus starts in the middle of Trixie's first row and heads diagonally up toward the left and diagonally up toward the right without ever ending. The same goes for Norton's curve that passes through inflaton values 80 or 70 and so on. The point is that each curve, connecting points with the same inflaton field value, represents all of space at a given moment of time, and each such curve extends indefinitely far, which means that the size of the bubble universe, according to its inhabitants, is infinite. This simply reflects that endless outsider time experienced by Trixie as the endless number of rows in her chart appears as endless space at each moment of time, according to an insider like Norton. That's a powerful insight. In Chapter 2, we found that the quilted multiverse was contingent upon space being infinitely large, something that, as we discussed, might or might not be the case. Now we see that each bubble within the inflationary multiverse is spatially finite from the outside, but spatially infinite from the inside. If the inflationary multiverse is real, inhabitants of a bubble, us, would thus not only be members of the inflationary multiverse, but of the quilted multiverse too. When I first learned of the quilted and inflationary multiverses, it was the inflationary variety that struck me as more plausible. Inflationary cosmology resolves a number of long-standing puzzles while yielding predictions that match up well with observations. And by the reasoning we've recounted, inflation is naturally a process that never ends. It produces bubble universe upon bubble universe, of which we inhabit but one. The quilted multiverse, on the other hand, by having its full force when space is not just large, but truly infinite, seemed avoidable. It might be the case, after all, that the universe has finite size. But we now see that eternal inflation's bubble universes, when properly analyzed from the viewpoint of their inhabitants, are spatially infinite. Inflationary parallel universes beget quilted ones. The best available cosmological theory for explaining the best available cosmological data leads us to think of ourselves as occupying one of a vast inflationary system of parallel universes, each of which harbors its own vast collection of quilted parallel universes. Cutting-edge research yields a cosmos in which there are not only parallel universes, but parallel universes. It suggests that reality is not only expansive, but abundantly expansive.
Chapter 4, Unifying Nature's Laws, On the Road to String Theory. From the Big Bang to inflation, modern cosmology traces its roots to a single scientific nexus, Einstein's general theory of relativity. With his new theory of gravity, Einstein upended the accepted conception of a rigid and immutable space and time. Science now had to embrace a dynamic cosmos. Contributions of this magnitude are rare. Yet Einstein dreamed of scaling even greater heights. With the mathematical arsenal and geometric intuition he'd amassed by the 1920s, he set out to develop a unified field theory. By this, Einstein meant a framework that would stitch all of nature's forces into a single, coherent mathematical tapestry. Rather than have one set of laws for these physical phenomena and a different set for those, Einstein wanted to fuse all the laws into a seamless whole. History has judged Einstein's decades of intense work toward unification as having had little lasting impact. The dream is noble, the timing was early. But others have taken up the mantle and have made substantial strides, the most refined proposal being string theory. My previous books, The Elegant Universe and The Fabric of the Cosmos, covered the history and essential features of string theory. In the years since they appeared, the theory's general health and status have faced a spate of public questioning, which is completely reasonable. For all its progress, string theory has yet to make definitive predictions whose experimental investigation could prove the theory right or wrong. As the next three multiverse varieties we will encounter in chapters 5 and 6 emerge from a string theoretic perspective, it's important to address the current state of the theory, as well as the prospects for making contact with experimental and observational data. Such is the charge of this chapter. A brief history of unification. At the time Einstein pursued the goal of unification, the known forces were gravity, described by his own general relativity, and electromagnetism, described by Maxwell's equations. Einstein envisioned melding the two into a single mathematical sentence that would articulate the workings of all of nature's forces. Einstein had high hopes for this unified theory. He considered Maxwell's 19th century work on unification an archetypal contribution to human thought, and rightly so. Before Maxwell, the electricity flowing through a wire, the force generated by a child's magnet, and the light streaming to Earth from the sun were viewed as three separate, unrelated phenomena. Maxwell revealed that, in actuality, they formed an intertwined scientific trinity. Electric currents produce magnetic fields. Magnets moving in the vicinity of a wire produce electric currents. And wave-like disturbances rippling through electric and magnetic fields produce light. Einstein anticipated that his own work would carry forward Maxwell's program of consolidation by making the next and possibly final move toward a fully unified description of nature's laws, a description that would unite electromagnetism and gravity. This wasn't a modest goal, and Einstein didn't take it lightly. He had an unparalleled capacity for single-minded devotion to problems he'd set for himself. And during the last 30 years of his life, the problem of unification became his prime obsession. His personal secretary and gatekeeper, Helen Dukas, was with Einstein at the Princeton Hospital during his penultimate day, April 17, 1955. She recounts how Einstein, bedridden but feeling a little stronger, asked for the pages of equations on which he had been endlessly manipulating mathematical symbols in the fading hope that the unified field theory would materialize. Einstein didn't rise with the morning sun. His final scribblings shed no further light on unification. Few of Einstein's contemporaries shared his passion for unification. From the mid-1920s through the mid-1960s, physicists guided by quantum mechanics were unlocking the secrets of the atom and learning how to harness its hidden powers. The lure of prying apart matter's constituents was immediate and powerful. While many agreed that unification was a laudable goal, it was only a passing interest in an age when theorists and experimenters were working hand in glove to reveal the laws of the microscopic realm. With Einstein's passing, work on unification ground to a halt. His failure was compounded when subsequent research showed that his quest for unity had been too narrowly focused. Not only had Einstein downplayed the role of quantum physics, he believed the unified theory would supersede quantum mechanics and so it needn't be incorporated from the outset. But his work failed to take account of two additional forces revealed by experiments, the strong nuclear force and the weak nuclear force. The former provides a powerful glue that holds together the nuclei of atoms, while the latter is responsible for, among other things, radioactive decay. Unification would need to combine not two forces, but four. Einstein's dream seemed all the more remote. During the late 1960s and 1970s, the tide turned. Physicists realized that the methods of quantum field theory, which had been successfully applied to the electromagnetic force, also provided descriptions of the weak and strong nuclear forces. All three of the non-gravitational forces could thus be described using the same mathematical language. Moreover, detailed study of these quantum field theories, most notably in the Nobel Prize-winning work of Sheldon Glashow, Steven Weinberg, and Abdus Salam, as well as in the subsequent insights of Glashow and his Harvard colleague Howard Georgi, revealed relationships suggesting a potential unity among the electromagnetic, weak, and strong nuclear forces. Following Einstein's nearly half-century-old lead, theoreticians argued that these three apparently distinct forces might actually be manifestations of a single monolithic force of nature. These were impressive advances toward unification, but set against the encouraging backdrop was a pesky problem. When scientists applied the methods of quantum field theory to nature's fourth force, gravity, the math just wouldn't work. Calculations involving quantum mechanics and Einstein's general relativistic description of the gravitational field yielded jarring results that amounted to mathematical gibberish. However successful general relativity and quantum mechanics had been in their native domains, the large and the small, the nonsensical output from the attempt to unite them spoke to a deep fissure in the understanding of nature's laws. If the laws you have prove mutually incompatible, then clearly the laws you have are not the right laws. Unification had been an aesthetic goal. Now it was transformed into a logical imperative. The mid-1980s witnessed the next pivotal development. That's when a new approach, superstring theory, captured the attention of the world's physicists. It ameliorated the hostility between general relativity and quantum mechanics, and so provided hope that gravity could be brought within a unified quantum mechanical fold. The era of superstring unification was born. Research proceeded at an intense pace, and thousands of journal pages were quickly filled with calculations that fleshed out aspects of the approach and laid the groundwork for its systematic formulation. An impressive and intricate mathematical structure emerged, but much about superstring theory, called string theory for short, remained mysterious. Then, beginning in the mid-1990s, theorists intent on unraveling those mysteries unexpectedly thrust string theory squarely into the multiverse narrative. Researchers had long known that the mathematical methods being used to analyze string theory invoked a variety of approximations and so were ripe for refinement. When some of those refinements were developed, researchers realized that the math suggested plainly that our universe might belong to a multiverse. In fact, the mathematics of string theory suggested not just one, but a number of different kinds of multiverses of which we might be a part. To fully grasp these compelling and contentious developments, and to assess their role in our ongoing search for the deep laws of the cosmos, we need to take a step back and first evaluate the state of string theory. Quantum fields redux. Let's begin by taking a closer look at the traditional, highly successful framework of quantum field theory. This will prepare us to discuss string unification as well as highlight pivotal connections between these two approaches for formulating nature's laws. Classical physics, as we saw in Chapter 3, describes a field as a kind of mist that permeates a region of space and can carry disturbances in the form of ripples and waves. Were Maxwell to describe the light that's now illuminating this text, if you were reading it, he'd wax enthusiastic about electromagnetic waves produced by the sun or by a nearby light bulb, undulating across space on their way to the printed page. He'd describe the wave's movement mathematically, using numbers to delineate the field's strength and direction at each point in space. An undulating field corresponds to undulating numbers. The field's numerical value at any given location cycles up and down and up again. When quantum mechanics is brought to bear on the concept of a field, the result is quantum field theory, which is characterized by two essential new features. We've already encountered both, but they're worth a refresher. First, quantum uncertainty causes the value of a field at each point in space to jitter randomly. Think of the fluctuating inflaton field from inflationary cosmology. Second, quantum mechanics establishes that, somewhat as water is composed of H2O molecules, A field is composed of infinitesimally small particles known as the field's quanta. For the electromagnetic field, the quanta are photons. And so a quantum theorist would modify Maxwell's classical description of your light bulb by saying that the bulb emits a steady stream comprising 100 billion billion photons each second. Decades of research have established that these features of quantum mechanics as applied to fields are completely general. Every field is subject to quantum jitters, and every field is associated with a species of particle. Electrons are quanta of the electron field. Quarks are quanta of the quark field. For a very rough mental image, physicists sometimes think of particles as knots or dense nuggets of their associated field. But this visualization notwithstanding, the mathematics of quantum field theory describes these particles as dots or points that have no spatial extent and no internal structure. Our confidence in quantum field theory comes from one essential fact. There is not a single experimental result that counters its predictions. To the contrary, data confirm the equations of quantum field theory describe the behavior of particles with astounding accuracy. The most impressive example comes from the quantum field theory of the electromagnetic force, quantum electrodynamics. Using it, physicists have undertaken detailed calculations of the electron's magnetic properties. The calculations are not easy, and the most refined versions have taken decades to complete, but they've been worth the effort. The results match actual measurements to a precision of 10 decimal places, an almost unimaginable agreement between theory and experiment. With such success, you might anticipate that quantum field theory would provide the mathematical framework for understanding all of nature's forces. An illustrious coterie of physicists shared this very expectation. By the late 1970s, the hard work of many of these visionaries had established that, indeed, the weak and strong nuclear forces fit squarely within the rubric of quantum field theory. Both forces are accurately described in terms of fields, the weak and the strong fields, that evolve and interact according to mathematical rules of quantum field theory. But as I indicated in the historical overview, many of these same physicists quickly realized that the story for nature's remaining force, gravity, was far subtler. Whenever the equations of general relativity commingled with those of quantum theory, the mathematics balked. Use the combined equations to calculate the quantum probability of some physical process, such as the chance of two electrons ricocheting off each other, given both their electromagnetic repulsion and their gravitational attraction, and you typically get the answer, infinity. While some things in the universe can be infinite, such as the extent of space and the quantity of matter that may fill it, probabilities are not among them. By definition, the value of a probability must be between 0 and 1, or in terms of percentages, between 0 and 100. An infinite probability does not mean that something is very likely to happen or is certain to happen. Rather, it's meaningless, like speaking of the 13th egg in an even dozen. An infinite probability sends a clear mathematical message. The combined equations are nonsense. Physicists trace the failure to the jitters of quantum uncertainty. Mathematical techniques have been developed for analyzing the jitters of the strong, weak, and electromagnetic fields. But when the same methods were applied to the gravitational field, a field that governs the curvature of space-time itself, they proved ineffective. This left the mathematics saturated with inconsistencies, such as infinite probabilities. To get a feel for why, imagine you're the landlord of an old house in San Francisco. If you have tenants who throw raucous parties, it might take effort to deal with the situation, but you don't worry that the festivities will compromise the building's structural integrity. However, if there's an earthquake, you're facing something far more serious. The fluctuations of the three non-gravitational forces, fields that are tenants within the house of space-time, are like the building's incessant partiers. It took a generation of theoretical physicists to grapple with their raucous jitters, but by the 1970s, they developed mathematical methods capable of describing the quantum properties of the non-gravitational forces. The fluctuations of the gravitational field, however, are qualitatively different. They're more like an earthquake. Because the gravitational field is woven within the very fabric of space-time, its quantum jitters shake the entire structure through and through. When used to analyze such pervasive quantum jitters, the mathematical methods collapsed. For years, physicists turned a blind eye to this problem because it surfaces only under the most extreme conditions. Gravity makes its mark when things are very massive, quantum mechanics when things are very small. And rare is the realm that is both small and massive, so that to describe it, you must invoke both quantum mechanics and general relativity. Yet, there are such realms. When gravity and quantum mechanics are together brought to bear on either the Big Bang or black holes, realms that do involve extremes of enormous mass squeezed to small size, the math falls apart at a critical point in the analyses, leaving us with unanswered questions regarding how the universe began and how, at the crushing center of a black hole, it might end. Moreover, and this is the truly daunting part, beyond the specific examples of black holes and the Big Bang, you can calculate how massive and how small a physical system needs to be for both gravity and quantum mechanics to play a significant role. The result is about 10 to the 19 times the mass of a single proton, the so-called Planck mass, squeezed into a fantastically small volume of about 10 to the minus 99 cubic centimeters, roughly a sphere with a radius of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, the so-called Planck length. The dominion of quantum gravity is thus more than a million billion times beyond the scales we can probe even with the world's most powerful accelerators. This vast expanse of uncharted territory could easily be rife with new fields and their associated particles, and who knows what else. To unify gravity and quantum mechanics requires trekking from here to there, grasping the known and the unknown across an enormous expanse that, for the most part, is experimentally inaccessible. That's a hugely ambitious task, and many scientists concluded that it was beyond reach. You can thus imagine the surprise and skepticism when in the mid-1980s, rumors started racing through the physics community that there had been a major theoretical breakthrough toward unification with an approach called string theory. String theory. Although string theory has an intimidating reputation, its basic idea is easy to grasp. We've seen that the standard view, prior to string theory, envisions nature's fundamental ingredients as point particles, dots with no internal structure, governed by the equations of quantum field theory. With each distinct species of particle is associated a distinct species of field. String theory challenges this picture by suggesting that the particles are not dots. Instead, the theory proposes that they're tiny, string-like vibrating filaments. Look closely enough at any particle previously deemed elementary, and the theory claims you'll find a minuscule vibrating string. Look deep inside an electron, and you'd find a string. Look deep inside a quark, and you'd find another string. With even more precise observations, the theory argues you'd notice that the strings within different kinds of particles are identical, the leitmotif of string unification, but vibrate in different patterns. An electron is less massive than a quark, which according to string theory means that the electron string vibrates less energetically than the quark string, reflecting again the equivalence of energy and mass embodied in E equals mc squared. The electron has an electric charge whose magnitude exceeds that of any quark, and this difference translates into other, finer differences between the string vibrational patterns associated with each. Much as different vibrational patterns of strings on a guitar produce different musical notes, different vibrational patterns of the filaments in string theory